Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. Tim, Michael, Mo, and the occasional guest discussing digital analytics issues of the day. Find them on Facebook at facebook.com/analyticshour and their website analyticshour.io. And now, the Digital Analytics Power Hour.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 102. You know, in our digital lives, the definition of disaster might be leaving the AdWords campaign turned on over the weekend or having our website go dark on Cyber Monday. But in the real world, there's nothing bigger in the disaster category than this big old hunk of rock we call home. The Earth just does what it does, and few things serve better as a reminder of our small place in the grander scheme of things than a natural disaster. And we do our best in the face of hurricanes and earthquakes, volcanoes, tornadoes, but there is always the quest for being better informed, being better at predicting, managing those risks. And guess what we use to do this? Data. Hence the tie-in for this show. So let's get to know our co-hosts.
Hi there. I'm Mo. I like to do stuff with data and analytics.
I'm Tim. I live on Earth and have periodically experienced weather.
And I'm Michael Hovling, also living here on Earth. And like Mo, do things with data and analytics. Okay, we don't know anything about natural disasters or the data that we need to manage them, but we went out and found an expert in this area, somebody who marshals the data, chases the storms, so that we could talk to her. Sherilyn Burris is a resilience and disaster risk reduction consultant. She's held numerous emergency management roles, most recently as emergency management chief of Manatee County, Florida. And today she runs Cassia Consulting, helping organizations develop personalized risk assessments from available data. And she is one of only two emergency managers in Florida who has been on Comedy Central. And now she's on our show. Welcome, Sherilyn.
Hi, guys.
Awesome.
Big step up from Comedy
yeah,
Central.
Yeah, exactly.
Woohoo! You actually planned to be on this show. Is it Manatee or Manatee? Is it Manatee County? Manatee?
Like the animal.
Manatee, like the animal.
Wait, how did I say it?
You said Manatee.
Manatee?
Manatee.
Oh, the humanity?
It's a southern
thing. Oh, the humanity.
Manatee.
It's Humanity County.
It's okay. I also pronounced Yehoshua wrong, apparently.
What is that?
It's a guy we know.
Oh, that.
I thought that was like a breed of dog or something. I'm like, I need to know. I have no idea
how many people have asked that question when they have met him in person.
That's okay. No one can pronounce my name. And if I go to Starbucks and have to like give your name to write it on their cup or something, you know, I just give some kind of really fake, obnoxious name because I have the same.
Wait,
yes.
Did Michael pronounce
yes,
your
he
name
did.
Correctly? Or was he close? Oh.
Yeah, it's a southern name.
That just makes Yehoshua sound feel that much worse.
There you
so
go.
That's perfect.
Well, okay, let's get back on track. Yehoshua being a natural disaster of a different kind. No, I'm just kidding. A natural, I don't know, phenomenon, I think is the right word. Sherilyn, it's great to have you on the show. I think to get us all on the same page, I'd love to hear just a little bit about your background and kind of what you do with your company and those kinds of things, just as a way to set the table and get the conversation started.
Cool. My background is a little long. I would say I never intended for this to be my career track. And it has been one of those fortuitous accidents. In 2004, I was working for the state of Florida in Tallahassee, and I was doing marketing research on agriculture. And because it's such a big agricultural state, when the 2004 hurricane season hit, we had just billions of dollars in losses. And part of my job was to tally that and see really how much money we were looking at for our losses. And in the end of 2004, I transferred over to the Florida Division of Emergency Management, and I had no idea what I was getting into. I was a public information officer, so mostly I talked to the media and to the general public. And then the 2005 hurricane season happened, and it sucked even worse than the year before. And I went to Hurricane Dennis outside of Pensacola, and then Hurricane Katrina in Mississippi, Hurricane Wilma in Broward County. And then I really haven't gotten off that boat. It hasn't slowed down. The train hasn't stopped. Just one disaster after another. And I really just fell in love with the way weather and technology interact and exchange with either really good or really bad human choices and the things that we can do to provide information. But I think largely because my first emergency management job was in information, I was kind of privileged. This is going to come out kind of odd, but during Hurricane Katrina, we didn't have a lot of people on hand. And when I got sent out there, you know, there just weren't enough resources to go around. And this sounds awful saying it out loud, but I was a young woman. I was in my early mid 20s and I knew how to type. And because I knew how to type and I was the only one that knew how to type with these, you know, bunch of old guys sitting around a, you know, fire station, I got invited to a lot of meetings that I probably wouldn't have been invited to otherwise, because you don't really want to tell that public information officer anything because they're going to go tell the media. But I got to sit in the back and listen to all of this information being exchanged without having a stake in it. So, you know, where were people in need? Where were resources available? You know, where's the link between those two? And I just got to soak all of it up like a sponge. And kind of ever since then, I've worked to kind of be the bridge between, you know, what people think they know and what I think they need to know. And I can tell when people aren't understanding the information that they're getting. So for disasters, you know, I can just watch their little faces glaze over when I tell them, you know, this is how high the water is going to be in your house. And a lot of my background now is just kind of fully evolved to be just a, like I said, kind of a bridge of information so that I know where people kind of want to go with their organization or with their plans. And then I just help them find random strengths that they didn't know they had for it. So a lot of that is very stakeholder based and community based. So just, you know, how to get the people involved in the conversation.
I thought this, we were going to not have this like tie directly to digital analytics. And then you talk about how to effectively communicate to stakeholders and make sure that they're actually understanding what you're talking about.
But they don't know anything about analytics though.
Right.
And it's kind of, it's, you're just giving them a nice little fluffy product at the end. Otherwise they're not on that journey because it's like trying to explain statistics to a bunch of third graders. Maybe, you know, it's, they just want the outcome and they just want the product. So, I mean, maybe it is and maybe it's not, but maybe it's a mix of both.
So this may be a slight little tangent, but do you deal with the expectation that what you're saying is certain or the truth? I almost feel like weather is one of those areas where people are a little more aware of the uncertainty in the data, but maybe not. They're expecting if you say the water is going to be 2 feet high in your house, give or take 18 inches, they're going to be like, no, how high is it going to be? Do you have to deal with that?
Oh, yeah, I laugh because so in hurricanes, we have what's called the cone of certainty. And we call it the cone of death, actually, because it's not certain at all. Those cones are designed to only be right 2 out of 3 times. So it's got a 66% chance of being certain.
Oh, is that literally like a plus or minus? That would be 1 standard deviation.
Yeah. Every third time that the storm goes out of that range of that cone. And it's designed to be that way. People don't know anything about weather probability. We suck at weather probability because if I say that we've got a 30% chance of rain today, what does everybody go out and say? They say, oh my God, it's going to rain today. And I have to say, that's not what I said. You know, I said there was a 30% chance. And we're even worse when it comes to the risk part of it. So if we say it's a 100-year flood, people go, oh my God, that means it's only going to flood once every 100 years. And like, no, that's not even remotely close to what that means. But we would like to think people understand the risk behind all of that or what it means, but no, they don't.
One of the show favorites people is a guy named Matt Gershaw who like talks about decision-making under uncertainty and probabilistic thinking. And I don't know, this is fascinating because I looked at it and I don't know if you're familiar with Nate Silver and The Signal and the Noise. And so he talks about weather a lot and talks about how forecasts have gotten way better, you know, within 100 miles instead of 350 miles of where it's going to hit. Still sucks at predicting the intensity, but he talks about sort of the cone of uncertainty or the what's it called?
Oh, now I'm going to have to look it up because I always call it the cone of death. And now I feel like I should know that.
The cone of, well, and so I kind of said, this is one area where we found a way to communicate to the stakeholders writ large that there's variability. But then you're like, well, no, because the actual variability is so wide that people would look at it and probably totally discount it because it would, the true cone of uncertainty or whatever it's called would be so broad that people would say, I can't work with that. So you have to narrow it, and then people get irked if it's not.
When it's wrong. Yep.
Fascinating.
It's almost like that the cone, you know, it's a very discrete area. If it were kind of shaded and tapered off instead of just being a, you know, a fine line between I'm in danger or I'm not in danger, if it was like a nice little red to pink to whatever instead, maybe that would communicate it a little differently.
So what are some of the consequences? I mean, obviously you have to make some big decisions. What are the consequences on when you're actually doing analysis about, I mean, if you make the call that a storm's going to hit somewhere and so you evacuate all these people and then it doesn't happen. I mean, do you guys like quadruple check everything? How does that actually impact the process that you go through when you're doing your analysis?
We only evacuate people if the threat of bodily harm is worse if they stay than it is to evacuate, because evacuations are dangerous too. But in Florida especially, and unfortunately all the other states have it way better than we do, we have two roads that go north out of our state. We have 20 million people. When you do the math, that is pretty unfortunate for us. So we have to make evacuation decisions based on how big our roads are and how many people we put on them all at the same time. And in South Florida's case, we had 6 million people evacuate for Hurricane Irma. It took about 5 days. And 5 days away, we had no idea where that storm was really going to go. We had, you know, a pretty solid idea, but even 24 hours before the storm, we didn't have a great idea. And so we have to make those evacuation decisions well in advance before we have a solid idea of where it's going to go. It just depends on how certain the forecasters are. And a lot of the National Hurricane Center, they're very transparent with their language, but you have to be very familiar with how they present stuff. So a couple of weeks ago, I had a quasi-conversation argument with someone because they were talking about hail being reported. And I said, did the Weather Service say it was reported or did they just say it was probable? And the person goes, well, I don't know. I'm like, well, there's a huge difference, you know. Did they just say there might be hail or did they say there is hail? And you could just see the person, they didn't understand the difference. And I, you know, a lot of that is they're just so caught up on the word hail and they just turn their blinders on to everything else. I mean, if you say disaster, people just kind of shut down and they, you know, they get very narrow focused instead of saying, well, you know, your risk of being eaten by a shark is pretty low, but aren't we all still afraid of sharks? Well, yeah. And a lot of that is just the way we process fear or the way we learn from past experiences to be able to even understand what a disaster actually is.
So the stakes are really high when it comes to disaster management. How do you keep your cool, or like what strategies do you use when you're trying to communicate the difference between like these tiny pieces of language to the listener they might not really even think about or notice, but to you the difference between it being likely and it's literally happening outside right now are very different. What kind of strategies do you use yourself to manage that when, because like during a crisis everyone just kind of goes a bit bananas?
Yeah, they do. I use very small words and very complete sentences. So you'll notice if you watch some of my press conferences, I speak very succinctly on what I want people to know and what I want people to do. And I don't give them a lot of information. The biggest difference that I saw when I studied some of the other folks was they would just drone on for 20 minutes on storm surge. And I'm like, I don't need to do that. I just need people to leave. People will, I think, subconsciously start to listen to that. So if you drone on for 20 minutes, then you distract them and you scare them and you confuse them. And now they don't know what to do. If you just say, here's what's going on, here's what you're going to do, and leave it at that. You know, when a disaster is already happening, it's way too late to provide any of that background information. So the more you can provide well in advance, so any kind of public education that you can get out, you know, in the months leading up, well before a storm, you're going to be better off because you don't have to go back and explain to somebody what storm surge is while it's already coming your way. But personally, I just try to get people to detach a little bit from it so that don't take it as personally. I'll tell you, when we had a category four coming our way, I had a couple of very scary moments where I really thought, you know, I'm going to go into work, and when I come back out, Florida is just going to be wiped off the map. And that's a very hard realization to know that nothing is going to be the same when you get to see it again, when the daylight comes back out. You know, everything you know and love is going to be gone. But if you can kind of get very focused and get lots of sleep and try to block other things out, you generally do a little better. But just, you know, the details are great, but at that point, I don't think we need that many.
So I want to shift gears a little bit and ask about the type of data that you use. Primarily, my experience with lots of government data sources is it can be pretty messy. It can be really manual, like kind of being dumped in CSVs. What kind of state is the data sources that you use and the rest of the team? And is there reaching a level of maturity in your industry, or is it all still kind of, yeah?
The data is so raw, and I don't know if it's because people don't have time to use it. Emergency management offices are generally very small. They're not analysts. You know, these are people that worked as EMS or law enforcement and just kind of, you know, inherited a job. But a lot of it is also because it's collected at the federal level and then kind of sent back down, it's maybe not the data that we would want to look at. So this morning I pulled up FEMA's open data source and just out of wild curiosity downloaded their housing assistance. And it's such a huge, just, you're right, it's a CSV file. And I kind of know what I'm looking at when I go through it. It's the housing type and then how bad the damage was and how many units and when it was inspected. And as a professional, I can understand it, but as a person who didn't do this for a living, I just know it would just be a bunch of numbers. And what I think we're missing in our industry is nobody has time to go back through all of these spreadsheets and say, wow, this zip code, you know, just got hammered. We need to focus on, you know, why they had so much damage in this one particular area so that next time we can figure out, you know, was it a very old neighborhood? Was it a very low-lying neighborhood? Was it people that lived in poverty and didn't have insurance? Like, why? Why was that damage so bad? But we don't have time to.
So what are the, I mean, there's weather data, which presumably in the States, that's National Weather mm-hmm. Service. You just mentioned FEMA data, which is presumably post-event right. data. Is there also like whatever local municipality or whatever, like what are the, I don't know, I'm trying to think of it as what's the data, but then also what are kind of the stages? Presumably there's an emergency preparedness need that may be looking at the data for X, Y, and Z, but then there's kind of, hey, this event's going to happen. Is that the same data or different data? Like what's kind of, do you have kind of a mental framework of the different aspects of emergency management and the different data sources and how they kind of dovetail?
There's endless data sources. I think if you can use it for anything, you can use it for emergency management. So if it's on how many people you have go get gas on Tuesday afternoon versus how many people go on Saturday afternoon, you know, even though that sounds really silly, that's important to us to be able to make a decision on saying, okay, well, if we're going to have to shut down fuel ports, how do we know when people have already gotten gas? You know, and that's just, it's kind of a trivial example, but the weather data is super cool lately with crowdsourced data and citizen science data being able to report what they see on the ground, because maybe that's not always what forecasters see on their radar. And so we've got that publicly available data. And then you're right, every city or jurisdiction or county or state has their own socio-demographic data. And the trick is lining those two up on top of each other to see where your gaps are. And one of the kind of, I don't know, silly examples is if it rains 6 inches at my house, my car is underwater. If it rains 6 inches at your house, you're probably still out playing golf. There's things that we just can't look at a spreadsheet and be able to tell. So somebody's got to really sit down and go through and say, well, this is historically the areas that we've seen flooding. And we can usually get that from 911 data, because when people drive their car through a flooded road, the first thing they always do is call 911, or even the same with trees down being in the road. What we did in Florida is we can take 911 call location data, what kind of call it was, and kind of even put it over our weather map of either where a tornado went through, where a hurricane or a flood happened, or a wildfire. And you can see the majority of the calls are exactly overlaid with where that storm damage was. And it's neat to then take socioeconomic data and lay that on top and say, well, these are the people that might need extra help. So if all of that damage was in a trailer park or, you know, a lower level of, you know, economic status, or a retirement home, or perhaps it's a tourist industry and nobody actually lives over there. So it's a bit of a, I would really hope my job gets computerized one day, because there's got to be a better way than going one by one on that little mental checklist.
What? So that's, I mean, what are the, so there's CSVs and Excel. Are there people using visualization, mapping visualization tools, R, Python? I mean, what's kind of the, in the world that you're in, what is actually being used to, I guess, crunch the data? And then presumably in the last 14 years or so, it sounds like you're saying, yes, the whole open data movement and digitization has made way more data accessible. So has that then shifted the way, or the where you're spending your time? The data is easier to get at, but now there's more work. There's more of it, more accessible, but it's right. More work to crunch it, or kind of how's that all work?
A lot of it is. So with the maps, we rely as an industry almost exclusively on Esri to be able to crunch that data for us.
That was the phrase, yeah. I was like, Esri, got it.
Right.
Yeah. And I was like, I know there's something out there that's a standard. Yeah, Esri. Okay.
There's more than that. You know, not that I'm going to be an endorsement, but it's so much easier to just show somebody a picture than say, here's a spreadsheet. You know, I don't have time to read a spreadsheet. I don't have time to basically even read an email. Just show me a picture of where the damage is. You know, maybe it's a heat map, or, you know, maybe it's a red, yellow, green, safe, kind of safe, unsafe. You know, it's just got to be pretty fast. So, you know, we use different software systems, but mostly it is Esri to do the lovely, beautiful story maps and things like that to show where the damage is or what kind it is.
And does that work such that you can, if you bring in data that's got geocoding in it, can you add in different data sets to Esri? I haven't worked with it.
Yeah. Okay. So they've done some really cool stuff. Esri and a lot of counties all over the states, not just us in Florida, use it to do damage assessment. So for instance, say I work for Orlando, I've got this nice little phone with me. I've got the Esri, you know, whatever downloaded on it. And my job is to go out and inspect buildings to see what's damaged and what's not. So I've got this system and I've got my little app, and I can walk over to a house and it's, you know, gone. And I can just punch in on my phone, you know, that's a 5 out of 5 as far as damage goes. And that goes automatically into whatever spreadsheet and database gets processed. And we can spit out a number on the other side if we've connected to our kind of the property assessment guys who know the value of that property. So we can tell you, here's where the damage is and here's the economic cost of what that damage is.
Do insurance, do like claims adjust, do private insurance companies' data go into a publicly available data set?
No, they don't give up their data at all.
Because how will they screw you later if they let you into that data?
Remember that they're in the business of making money and the government usually is not. So most private industries don't turn over their data. Power companies and cell phone companies have gotten a lot better about turning over theirs just because they want to be transparent and, you know, the whole corporate responsibility movement. But as far as, you know, the insurance company damage, that is probably some priceless data, because you know exactly what's wrong with that home, or, you know, how many people needed help.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about data sets, one of the ones that gets mentioned in the news a lot is the Waffle House Index. So what is that real? Do people actually use that?
I love this one. So when I first started working in emergency management, I worked for Craig Fugate, who kind of came up with that. And
you want to explain what the Waffle House Index is, just for the
people?
Assuming that is not a globally not a universal. I'm vaguely aware of it, but.
So we have a lot of Waffle Houses in Florida and Georgia. So I don't know where there is a lot of Waffle Houses. Otherwise,
currently Googling Waffle House.
Like, how many of them and where
you
are they?
Gotta come.
Oh, you like a restaurant?
It's a restaurant.
It's a restaurant.
Yeah. It's a 24-hour diner.
I need to way backpedal then.
I thought it was it's a house.
They got waffles. So it's a 24-hour diner. It's so like good, a, Mo. You know, you can get your hash browns whatever way you want. So if Waffle House is open, your town is generally doing okay. You might have some damage. You might, you know, have some debris or your electricity's out. So if Waffle House is open, you need people to work. You need food. You need electricity. You need some kind of way to run a credit card if you need to. Your building has to be there and you should probably have a parking lot. And then, of course, you need customers. So the Waffle House Index is saying physically we're okay, economically okay, logistically with supplies, we're okay. But if all your Waffle Houses are closed, your town is having a pretty bad day. It's not a real index, but it was one of those ways I think that we try to make light of the situation a little bit. That, you know, healthy, happy coping mechanisms of working in death and destruction every day.
Oh, I was hoping it was real. That was okay.
Does Waffle House, like, do they embrace or like, do they, you would think that would be positive for them from a marketing perspective? Cause they're like,
it's a lot of good PR for them, I would imagine.
It is. And they embraced it. They appreciate it. It's not that it's not real, you know, it's as real as you want it to be, but they have a corporate response team. I think they kind of probably made it because Craig Fugate really pushed that Waffle House Index. So they embrace it and they'll come out and get their Waffle Houses up and running because they know a hot meal makes a big difference after disaster.
Yeah. Personally, having dealt with a Waffle House and a natural disaster under, you know, that was when we got 2 inches of snow here in Atlanta.
Total disaster. Epic. Epic proportions.
It actually was. That was the sad thing about it. It was
there was the remote worker from the Bay Area who had flown in for the week and wound up sleeping on a.
We all have our stories, but we went to a Waffle House and we were sitting there, and it was a very interesting experience. Those poor people at the Waffle House, I think, had been there for 36 hours. It was really bad. Anyways, sorry. The Waffle House Index is just amazingly humorous to me because of that experience. But I'm glad to hear that it's not necessarily a real way that we manage things.
No, it's a lot more technical than that. But like the 500-year flood thing, it's just if we got to communicate it in 30 seconds or less, it's the way we got to do it.
So Florida's obviously kind of it's just kind of like Tornado Alley there. I assume there are different areas of the U.S. that are more or less prone and they similar sort of things they're dealing with. Do you have a sense of how other countries kind of tend to address just kind of structurally what data is available, how they manage even their kind of governmental services infrastructure? Is there sharing of best practices or different structural differences?
We really do try to study people that have done it right. So the Netherlands does a lot with flood mitigation because they're under sea level, kind of like New Orleans. And so they built a lot of dikes and levees and all sorts of things to help prevent them from being totally underwater. And we study what the Japanese do to prepare for tsunamis. I actually study a lot of what other countries do to communicate risk to people. So maybe it's not necessarily how they build their buildings, but what are they telling their residents to be able to make better decisions for themselves? In Australia, they have hurricanes as well. So it's kind of neat to study somewhere on the other side of the world having the same exact problems that we do. But it's a little harder to compare, you know, if we can't build something like that in America, if it's too expensive to do it, or Japan's risk is higher, or, you know, their topography is different, or their resources are different. So as much as we can, we really do try to pilfer and steal other people's best practices. And some of them, we just can't.
What part of Australia, Mo, where do hurricanes hit?
We have cyclones and I've...
Cyclones, sorry. Which hemisphere?
I used to live in an area that... was cyclone prone and had to catch an inflatable boat over to our office because there was so much flooding. So yeah, definitely been there. It's pretty scary. But I'm curious about how your messaging can get politicized, because that happens to us in the analytics space as well, where someone in the company has a particular agenda that they want to push or a message or something they want people to action. And in this case, the stakes are so much higher. How have you managed that?
Oh, we smile and nod a lot. Disasters are so politicized here in the States, and it's kind of used as a divisive tool. One of the better examples, and I won't tell you who it was, but it was a long time ago during Hurricane Wilma. I was working in South Florida, and I think I had been sleeping on the floor for about 2 weeks by this point, and I was working in a county that had about 30 different cities. So some of the cities had 200 or 300 people, and then some of the cities had 200 or 300,000 people. And you know, there was a lot of wind damage in this community, so people wanted blue tarps to put on their roof. You know, it's because it rains every day. And so some of these mayors got 500 tarps, and then you'd have another mayor come over and say, well, you gave him 500 tarps, you need to give me 500 tarps. And I would say, you don't have 500 homes in your community. And, you know, I can't. And it was like a, excuse my language, but it was a pissing contest on, you know, everybody wants the same things. So I think politicians have a big problem with absolute versus, you know, reference numbers to say, I try to help politicians where I can, but you're right. They want you to help their people without regards to the information behind it to say, you know, do you need help? The cost of disasters, I think, is one of the reasons why it just becomes a political agenda, because, you know, we're looking at, you know, millions, if not billions of dollars for disasters. And it's almost the way we have it set up in the States. It's like winning the ugliest dog contest. So all these politicians get together and they want to see who can get the most money from FEMA. Like, well, if you get the most money from FEMA, it means that you have done the worst job trying to prepare your residents. So that's not an achievement and that's not a good thing, but yet that's the mentality. And so I try to work to say, you know, here's, you're not going to get $10 million because you didn't get $10 million of damage, and that's a good thing. But it just doesn't really work like that all of the time.
But it's a structural. So on the one hand, they want, the politicians are going to say, we put in the right preparation, we manage the actual event itself.
Right.
We did the best we possibly could. At the same time, they also want to go and say, we maximized the amount of federal relief we got. And those, you're saying those are kind of, there's a tension there, and they kind of have to sort of speak out of both sides of their mouths to be effective politicians, I guess.
Yeah, I guess it's that typical old adage, right? Those that prepare the best are probably going to have hopefully less troubles, but then at the end won't get the reward and the accolades, I suppose, when it comes to funding or perceived funding. Man, your job sounds tough.
Well, where does the, because to me, the preparedness is kind of the, this fascinating, like you said, I can't remember if it was before we were recording or now, the 100-year, you know, you're in a 100-year floodplain. So what does that mean? How much should I be investing in flood preparedness or flood insurance or whatever the ways I can prepare for flood, given that it's a 100-year flood? Like, where does that, and I assume the same is for municipalities, saying how much of our taxpayer dollars do we want to invest in a low probability, but certainly not a zero probability event? Do you wind up, and is that what you're doing? Is that now what you're doing now in the consultancy, is largely the preparedness piece?
Right. Yeah. And it's how do you walk that fine line between what's most likely to happen and then what's most awful if it happens? So we kind of have to do a trade-off between the 500 and 100-year flood are a little easier to communicate because there are solid ways that you can decrease your risk, or, you know, promote getting insurance, or, hey, quit building in a flood zone. Yeah. But there are different things that don't really have those nice little boxed up solutions, like an infectious disease outbreak or a terrorist attack. So even though those things are very unlikely to happen, when they do happen, it's so much worse with infectious disease, because, you know, it really impacts how we live our lives as humans and how we, you know, go to the mall or get on an airplane and how we interact every day of our lives. And then, of course, with an active shooter, you have that huge emotional and mental health piece. And those things, those kind of outcomes and impacts for those events don't have a dollar amount behind them. And so it's very hard to get communities to pay money to prepare for something that doesn't have a monetary return on it.
So how much of your job then would be in helping areas prepare versus respond after an event?
I would prefer it be 100% on the preparedness and none on the response, because at the response phase, it's almost too late at that point to do anything about it. So, you know, responders get all of the credit. They rush in. It's very sexy. It's on TV. You know, they got the uniforms on and they give out water, and it's all very, very glamorous. But when it comes down to it,
they throw toilet paper or paper towels.
Right, like, yeah. Because
that's just...
Oh, in Australia, sorry. They save koalas. You always see the firemen with the koala.
Well, that's where all the photo ops with the politicians, right?
Right, giving out that bottle of water.
They're not in the controls. They're not in the control center looking at like data curves to determine whether an evacuation is necessary. They're in the pulling stuff off a truck afterwards, handing it to a little old lady.
Right, and that's really what sells votes. And it's kind of crappy with their response, but. So I use the example of Biloxi, Mississippi. And if you guys are familiar with it, if you went before Hurricane Katrina and then you went now, you know, God, it's been 13 years. It took them over 10 years to get to their economic point where they were before the storm. But America spent billions of dollars on this response, all on the response, but it didn't actually make a measurable difference on whether that community recovered. So, you know, I've slept on the ground. I have slept in an empty abandoned ammunition factory. I've slept under desks. That's what you do in response. So if there's anything I can ever do to have to avoid that, I will gladly prepare all day long.
So if you can't even make this, if Katrina exactly hit again today, is that a thought experiment or is that go into the planning? Like how does Biloxi, Mississippi come out of Katrina hitting today than it did hitting 13 years ago? Is part of that rebuilding, is that we've had this, so therefore I'm now receptive to a preparedness message for some finite window, which again, I'm thinking of like the website crashes on Cyber Monday and all of a sudden the IT department gets very well funded for their capacity for the website load. Is that a phenomenon as well, that there's a window after the disaster where you, all of a sudden people are listening to you saying, what do I need to do? What do I need to do to make this work better?
Yeah, you'll notice all of our funding, after anything bad happens, all of our funding goes up after. So after 9/11, all of our funding for terrorism skyrocketed. After SARS, all of our funding for infectious disease just skyrocketed. And after hurricanes, it does the same thing. But after a couple years go by that there's nothing bad happening, all that funding goes back down. And unfortunately, when the funding goes down, our capability to respond also goes down. So it's just this vicious circle that we can't get out of because we can't keep the funding at a sustainable level to keep it from happening again. So if Katrina hit again, I honestly think that the exact same thing would happen because we haven't had a steady stream of funding into it.
Well, it's a good thing that weather is kind of tapering off and kind of getting milder over time.
that is depressing.
interesting. This was, as you were talking about, the things like the SARS or the active shooter that are very low. I'm reading a book that's taking me a while to get through about Bayesian thinking, and it talks about during the Cold War, there was a discussion of what's the likelihood of a nuclear disaster? Because there had not been any outside of test lab development. And there was kind of the frequentist school of thinking is saying it's never happened. We therefore can't predict its probability. Whereas there was kind of the Bayesians were saying, yeah, we can. Like we can think logically, apply some subject matter expertise, assign probabilities to the different failure points. And supposedly coming out of that, there was a recognition that there was actually a decent level of risk that, you know, a plane would crash that was carrying a nuclear warhead and would cause a major disaster, which led to a bunch of preparedness investments because they were trying to predict the likelihood of something happening that had never really happened. And it was kind of a fascinating, but even telling that story, they still had to get somebody with the controlling the purse strings to buy into the approach. Like it does seem like if you talk about pandemics, you know, a pandemic hasn't hit the US. So
don't say stuff like that. We're super superstitious.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry.
It's 100-year anniversary of the Spanish influenza outbreak. So,
but I think that's the point. Like if it hasn't happened, doesn't mean it won't, but from a communication, right? That is the sort of challenge. I feel like we've been talking extreme weather events and all of a sudden you're like, hello, there are lots of other types of disasters that have nothing to do with the weather.
Well, and then the other thing is do you find that there are people who are also overhyping? Like, because I think local news and meteorologists want you to think that, you know, this thunderstorm is going to be the worst one to ever hit your neighborhood. And so how do you deal with sort of the deadening effect, I guess, of like just hearing it all the time? Also, the new Weather Channel things where they show the flood like going up around the person on the video screen. I don't know if you've seen those YouTube videos. Pretty friggin' awesome. No, but like, what is the response to that? Because that's sort of the other side of like, people are just sort of like, nah, I'm good. I'll ride this one out, kind of.
It, you know, we try to get really good at predicting weather, and we're going to shoot ourselves in the foot one of these days with how close it's going to be to somebody's house. But when I see those people on TV, and when I worked with the media during the 2005 hurricane season, I just had to laugh a little bit, because they are trying to sell news. So they've right. got a bottom line, and I didn't. So a lot of what their message was unfortunately driven at a corporate level and not a public safety level. And in my job now, I just make a point to be very good friends with pretty much every reporter I find, so that I can educate them on what's going on, so that they can look like a really good subject matter expert on TV and say all the right things and, you know, get the right message out there. And a lot of it is, if the media doesn't trust the local official and what they're saying, then yeah, they're probably going to go off the rails. They're probably also going to go out and put themselves in danger, which is just, I really wish they would stop doing that. And I think they even gave Jim Cantore an award for it the other day. I'm like, please don't do that. Right. Don't get on the news and tell people all their kids are going to die or something like that.
Stop, you know, reinforcing bad decisions.
Well, somebody did that. So that was actually Hurricane Harvey. Right. Thank goodness it wasn't Florida. But you know, we have the opposite too, where all of these people put out horrible messages like evacuate now, leave now, you know, your house is going to be gone. And then like Mo was saying at the beginning, and then nothing happens. So then how do you get people back on board to say, oh, you know, it's just the chance that your house could have been wiped away. It wasn't that it was going to get wiped away.
Well, here in Georgia, we still go buy all the bread, eggs, and milk anyways.
Well, we call that the French toast scale or the French. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. It's ridiculous. French it's the only index. Three things people, they empty out the store of those three items and that's it. Everything else is still there. Yes. It's the most ridiculous thing. Anyways.
I think we're the opposite. We go like straight for the canned goods and the beer.
No, you gotta get them staples. I don't get it either. It's so crazy. If we can't get to Waffle House, we better make French toast. Like, that's...
Now, did you guys must have, you don't lose power during one of those snowstorms, apparently. It's like Mo was saying, we get everything in a can because we don't have electricity to make French toast. So you better drink that beer warm.
Yeah, it all depends. I mean, there's people that lose power and those kinds of things. Anyways, do not mean to minimize storms and people's response to them.
No, again, we just we have to laugh to keep from crying. There you go.
Well, and
sorry, but what Sherilyn just made a really good point that I want to hone in on. So apparently to be the quintessential analyst, I just need to make friends with everyone and make them look really smart and know what to say when. And then like job's done. Kind of that I had a mini epiphany.
Yeah, but the catch is you can't ever be wrong.
Oh, wow. We really are the quintessential analyst now.
There you go.
But other than that, you're right.
All right. Well, we have got to wrap up. And I wish we didn't, because this is actually a really fun conversation. And thank you, Sherilyn, for coming on. One of the things we love to do is go around the horn and just share a last call, something we found in the last few weeks that we think is interesting. It might be of interest to our listeners. So, Sherilyn, you're our guest. So do you have a last call you want to share?
My dog has an Instagram, and he is really funny.
Nice.
We call him a hurricane-ine. It's a little plan.
Wait, how old is this dog, right? Because you were saying...
So my old Chihuahua died in January at 19. And in March, I got a phone call from an animal rescuer. And she said, I have a puppy. It was a confiscation. I need you to just take care of the puppy because they don't do well in the shelter. So I was like, oh, sure. So I walk over and I go to pick up this little dog. And he was so stinking cute. And I took the dog to work with me all the time. So he is extremely friendly. He's very, very well versed in hurricanes. His name is Cooper. And he's about, I would think he was probably born in February. So maybe he's about 8 months old. I don't know.
All right.
So sorry, Hurricane Cooper? Is that his?
Hurricane 9. It's kind of a little play on words. It's Cooper Hurricane 9. but I'll send it
all
to
you. All right. Well, cool. We'll hopefully get the big analytics power hour bump to his Instagram followers. Dog. I don't think that's actually a thing. I think we've tried to test it. I don't believe we provide a bump. So sorry no about worries. That. All right.
I kind of wonder if by mentioning the dog, the last dog that has died, we have not yet kind of worked in the adventures of Butterbean and Yoga Dog. I'm not going to make that my last call, but
you can do a twofer, Tim.
I never do twofers. That's mine are right. always short.
The New Year's.
Currently receiving a stern look from one Mo Kiss.
That's right.
So that would be Sherilyn's book. We will also link to that. So you can kind of look to retire soon based on the Amazon book sales of
you got to have a pet preparedness plan.
That's true. All right, Tim, what is your last call?
So I am going to call an audible because it's actually, I saw it recently and it is actually related to what we are talking about here. There was a guy on Twitter named @EvanTichovsky who basically has posted our code for making New York Times style building maps for whatever your zip code is. So for the R users out there, there is a little bit of code where you basically have to download some files and then you get kind of the building map level detail of whatever zip code you're interested in, which seems like it has a lot of potential to have some fun with some visualization of overlaying weather or other related data on it.
That's so show appropriate.
Well, I just changed it. Like I was frantically looking for it because it came up.
You're like, oh, I'll use that instead. All right, Mo, what do you got?
All right. I want to share an article by Elena Grill. I think I'm saying her name right, hence the inflection. She leads the data science team at Airbnb, which is like 120 people plus now. But the article is on how one data science job doesn't fit them all. But there's something in the article in particular that I really like the idea of, and I think it's something we face in analytics. She was talking about how lots of the team members who were doing analytics work felt like their work wasn't as valued by the business as those doing machine learning work, even though what they were doing was completely critical. So they basically realigned their teams into three teams. So data science analytics, data science algorithms, and data science inference.
Did you say inference?
Yeah. They've kind of just gone down the approach of calling everyone a data scientist, even if they're doing analytics work. But I really do like kind of how they heard and addressed and dealt with the fact that those who were not doing like the sexy machine learning stuff still added a lot of value to the business. And how did they make sure that those staff members felt that their work was valued? So it's a really interesting article on LinkedIn and we'll share that in the show notes.
That's awesome. Michael, as a data science manager, what's your what's your last call?
Tim, mine's a twofer. So I discovered something very interesting in that I switched to rum for this recording because we're talking a lot about hurricanes.
because we're talking about hurricanes. Nice.
But I actually think it makes my face red. So there you go. That's a really key learning I found out tonight. So that's good. Not
I'm glad
actually.
You have two today.
Yeah. No, that's really important. No, my real one is actually a book that I'm reading. Tim listens to podcasts. I read books. It's called Measure What Matters by John Doerr. And it's about objectives and key results, or OKRs, which is a way of mapping kind of what you intend to accomplish to the outcomes of the metrics that you're going to use to measure it. We use it in our business, but I actually just really have enjoyed reading the book and all the cool stories in it. So highly recommend it. And okay, there we go.
Now I'm realizing we like literally did not ask Sherilyn the question of like how is like performance measured in the disaster management?
Very badly.
Yeah, I mean, that's like what does it sounds like success?
Maybe that was the theme of the show.
Success is measured in a lot of different ways because if you're a local official, it's by more FEMA money, and if you're a preparedness person, it's by maybe like people not dying and. I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah. We have a lot of people call and complain, and I know this sounds really awful, but when they would call and complain about things like they didn't like their chicken nuggets at the hurricane shelter, I would say something really awful that goes, you're alive to complain. So I'm doing the heart of my job. A lot of it is just a little bit of perspective. With my job, it's I need to make sure we save lives, but sometimes it's making sure those chicken nuggets are tasty.
That's a misalignment on Maslow's hierarchy perspective, it sounds like.
Yeah, let's take some pride in our nuggets here, people, though. So let's step it up next time so that Sherilyn doesn't have to deal with that. Okay, if you've been listening, there's two distinct segments of our audience I want to address at this moment. The first is sort of everyone with the typical end of show. We'd love to hear from you. The second is analysts who are looking to advance and accelerate their careers. I think this episode actually represents an amazing opportunity. There's a ton of publicly available data and publicly available tools around disaster analysis and recovery and preparation. And if you are an analyst who is looking for ways to showcase your skills, this might actually be an extremely viable avenue for you to both burnish your reputation and resume, as well as do the public some good. So I'm just throwing that out there. There's a lot of data sources, and maybe if you're really nice, you can even follow Sherilyn on Twitter and ask her questions, which if she has time, she may even answer. And there's lots of other things out there.
If not, her dog might.
Her dog is also available to field questions on his Instagram. So, but I just want to throw that out there because it's been ringing in my head. Like, man, there's a lot of people and who are like, how do I get experience? How do I show that I can do this? Sounds like there's publicly available data and a real need, and that's an opportunity. So that's something I just want to throw out there. For the rest of you who are like, don't care about your careers and doing good, just keep listening to the show. We'd love to hear from you. Or if you've been in a hurricane or a natural disaster, I'm sure Sherilyn wants to hear your story. No, I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. It's only because like I almost
started talking about I do want to hear those stories.
Like, it's from the Atlanta apocalypse. And I was like, stop, Michael. Everyone has a story. You don't need to share yours right now.
No, maybe if you shared your story, though, people will learn from what to do or not to do during their emergency.
Well, my story was best showcased by the SNL sketch with the Seth Meyers news segment, if you recall that one. Southery.
I think he did a few news segments.
He had a guy on from the South who was in the storm, and he was like, it was terrible. Southery. It was like this white stuff floated down from the sky. So I did the only logical thing. I jumped into my white Escalade and got on the interstate.
Oh God.
Yeah. Anyways,
this is the slowest wrap up in history. Our poor listeners were like, oh, they're on last calls. This is nearly done. No.
Mo, I'm trying a lot of new things, Mo. We're episode 102. We've got to like drum up the personal interest side of this a little more. Just go with it. Anyways, we would love to hear from you. Tim can edit this all in post. It's not a big deal. For my two co-hosts who are sort of amazed by my amazing closure skills and our guest, Sherilyn, for all of you out there, no matter what you do and in any kind of weather, keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to join the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Measure Slack group. We welcome your comments and questions. Visit us on the web at analyticshour.io, facebook.com/analyticshour, or at analyticshour on Twitter.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
Michael, did you want to kind of overtly call this out as one of the, like, hey, this is not a digital analytics topic, but like we've done in the past, or no, you just figure it'll be obvious?
Yeah, I think people will get it.
Okay. I guess I'm just...
This show's not about digital analytics.
Our governor wouldn't let him say the word climate change during a Senate hearing, or a congressional hearing of some sort. And so you can watch this guy's face use the word atmospheric redeployment. And you can just see him, like, you know, just trying to bite his tongue.
I'm good at the internet. I'll figure it out. Oh, okay. You got a link. She's guarding the front door because she's certain that someone's coming to kill us.
So. Okay.
Oh, good. You were recording that, so if you want to make that update, you can.
had to buy a suit, and I told him he could wear a jacket and chinos. So it's really not
I did
that.
Not buy a suit because you said I was showing pictures of you and your and Jamie to the guy at the Joseph A. Bank saying we were told cocktail attire with bow ties, and then they sent us this picture. This is the bride and the groom, and she said this would work. So I own a freaking bow tie. But
you're gonna wear carry a bow tie? That's gonna be amazing.
Shit.
No, I talk over Mo, and then everybody says I'm mean to Mo, and then so.
No, we talk over each other. It's not just a you thing. Anyway,
Mo, you're up.
So Sherilyn, I'm trying to find your dog on Instagram via my own dog's Instagram, and I'm still struggling because apparently Hurricane9 is very common dog Instagram.
Still recording. We're still recording.
That makes it all the better. No.
Rock flag and natural disasters.